This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, today's guest is Chris Ballew, lead vocalist and bassist for the Seattle, Washington rock band, Presidents of the United States of America. Together, we pull back the curtains and take a deep dive into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the smash hit single, Peaches, taken from their 1995 self-titled debut album. It's a glorious day here at Chris to Makes a Podcast, as we celebrate our 200th episode by bringing Chris back. He's a repeat offender, having sat in with us before on April 25th, 2022, on what was then our 100th episode. Chris is awesome. His approach to songwriting and sound is unique, and the story behind Peaches is absolutely insane. Chris recalls taking LSD in 1990, and decided to profess his love for a woman he knew. From there, a chance encounter on the street with a stranger some years later triggered that earlier memory from 1990, and Peaches was born. Sound weird? It is, but it gets weirder. Have you ever heard of anyone running their bass guitar through an amp made specifically for an accordion? Well, neither have I, until Chris told me that's exactly how he got the bass sound for Peaches. So yeah, it gets even wackier. So sit back, grab a nice sweet peach, and let's dive into this awesome episode.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Chris, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. You were here last on April 25th, 2022, where we broke down Lump. And I might have even mentioned in the episode up to that point, that was probably one of the more odd songs we've ever had that was a hit single. I think Peaches has it beat, buddy.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, Lump is the core, kind of like a four on the floor rock song. But this Peaches song is trippy and bizarre and shifts gears and has a whole end part that doesn't match with the rest of the song. Yeah, so it's quite a journey.
You just basically summed up the episode. I think I'm going to take that what you just said and have it at the top to as the introduction, because that's right. Exactly it. It's kind of like two songs in one. For Lump, if I recall correctly, you did send us a demo of that. I looked online. Is there a demo of Peaches? I couldn't find one.
No, there's no demo of Peaches. Because of the way it came to be, it skipped the demo phase. I actually didn't have a four-track. I borrowed a four-track to demo Lump, and Peaches was sort of coming together at the same time, but it really came together in the rehearsal space with the band. It was more of a, like, I walked in with a verse and a chorus, and then we made it into a song as a band. So yeah, it was strangely, bizarrely skipped the demo phase. I was all about weird demos back in the day, but that one missed that boat.
Well, and I got to ask, looking back and researching the episode, I didn't realize, I just always assumed Lump was, but I guess Kitty was the first single released. And can you talk about that a little bit when that song came out? Because obviously that wasn't the hit that Lump and Peaches was. You look confused, like maybe Kitty wasn't the first single?
I don't think it was. I think Lump was the first single because at least the first video I remember releasing, because we had a giant shooting day in Seattle with Roman Coppola, our director. We ended up making two videos for Lump out of that footage that we shot in that single day. And so, yeah, that to me was my inaugural experience with a single and a video, and everything was Lump. And I think Kitty came a little later. Yeah, I think we did Lump, we did Peaches, and then we did Kitty, then and Dune Buggy. So that was the order I remember. But you know what? The 90s are pretty hazy.
I think they're a little hazy for everybody. But, you know, if you remember correctly, labels would sometimes go with a leader track or a, what's the term they would use? Like a test track. They'd put teaser, something out.
Like a teaser track?
Yeah, like a teaser track. And maybe, according to Wikipedia, it was released first. So it's here nor there. I always assume Lump, like you, was it. But yeah. Peaches, talk to me. Take us back to writing it. What was the initial inspiration? What did the guys think of it? Because it is so odd.
Yeah. Well, first I've got to do this. If I'm going to go back in time, I've got to go. Now I'm back. I'm back. So I was living in Boston in 1990 with Mark Sandman, who is the two-string slide bassist and lead singer-songwriter for Morphine. And I had a little space. He had a loft space, and I had a little corner that was mine, and I had a four-track. And one day I had nothing else to do, so I took this little drug called LSD, fantastic little substance, and I went for a walk. And it was a very eventful walk in other ways. There were other weird things that happened, of course, when you walk around Boston on LSD. But one of the things that happened was I was kind of hanging out with and busking with and kind of getting to be friends with this person named Mary Lou Lord. She would set up in Harvard Square in front of the Harvard Co-op, and we would use that same space and take turns occupying that space. So we had a history together, and I had kind of developed a bit of a crush on her. And I decided I was going to go to her house and tell her how I feel. So I figured, you know, taking acid was the best first step when you're going to go tell that you have a crush on her. So I did that. I walked over to her house. Now, I got to set the scene because her house was in a kind of single-story industrial gray building kind of section of Cambridge. And her house was this architectural standout because it looked like the house that Tweety Bird and Grandma lived in the Warner Brothers cartoons.
Okay.
Yeah, it was yellow with a white picket fence and, you know, lots of gables and kind of Victorian. It looked like a big yellow cookie. And this is not just the drugs talking. I had been there before and I knew it. And in the yard, in the front yard, is a peach tree. And so I go to the front door, knock and everything, no response. She's obviously not home. So I plant myself under the peach tree and the drugs are really kicking in at this point. And I just start taking peaches and smashing them and crushing them and opening them and kind of vibing on these peaches. And, she never came. She never showed up. So I took all my, you know, unrequited love and went back home and just kind of continued on my little drug day and had a great time. It didn't immediately turn into a song. It just was an experience. And I was writing other songs, of course, but that experience didn't kind of blossom into something sonic yet. Then I moved back to Seattle. That happened in maybe like 1990. And then I moved back to Seattle kind of for good in 93. And I didn't have a car and I had I'd sold my car. So I was waiting at a bus stop to go see my then girlfriend who would become my first wife, Mary Lynn. And I'm waiting at this bus stop and a man in a greasy trench coat with matted hair, you know, presenting definitely as a shelter challenged individual. We would have said homeless back in the day. I don't know if that's a derogatory term now, but so he came shuffling by and under his breath, he's going, "Move into the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches, move into the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches." He's just saying it over and over like a mantra. And he just kind of slowly shuffled by and I kind of got infected by his little groove. And I was like, yeah, that's a cool little groove. And eventually I sort of remembered this experience I'd had in Boston and sort of used that homeless man's ramblings to sort of turn it into a song. And then it kind of turned into a song. It blossomed. But I only had verse, chorus, verse, chorus. And it was later when I showed the song to Dave and Jason, they dug it. They thought I was going in the right direction, but we didn't have anywhere else to go. You know, it was not, it didn't really scream to have a big kick-ass solo in it or anything. So Dave Dieterer, actually the guitar player in the Presidents, he came up with the whole end part, the millions of peaches, peaches for me, that whole riff and those lyrics are Dave. So it's one of the things that I really adore about this song is that it was a real Lennon and McCartney moment, which we didn't have a lot of in the band. Dave was really good at tightening my arrangements and focusing my lyrics and sort of, you know, helping hone in on what made the song successful. But this was a case where he wrote the whole very memorable part to the song. So that was cool. Yeah, so that kind of got the song up and running. And I, like I said before, it skipped the demo phase because I didn't have a four track. I had borrowed a four track from a friend to demo Lump and I think Dune Buggy and maybe Kitty, or I can't remember what, but I didn't have a four track that day. I think I had given the four track back to the person I borrowed it from. A side note, interesting side note, the person I borrowed the four track from was Lori Goldston, who was the cello player for Nirvana during the live
unplugged.
Yeah, live
unplugged. You're kidding me.
Yeah. So whenever I see that, like something from that, I say, oh, there's Lori. I couldn't have done it without her four track.
Why do I feel like I'm tripping all of a sudden, Chris? This story just keeps getting, I mean, who does this happen to? You, I guess.
Yeah.
I have so many questions. So, you know, was when you saw the unhoused man walking along, mumbling, moving to the country, going to eat some peaches, when that triggered the memory from however many years prior, 4 or 5 years prior, when you were, you know, 1990, did you recall the demo? And did you make a demo in 90? You said you were working on it. Did you have anything from that period to reference?
No, nothing. Nothing. Just the memory of the experience. Like I had not been visited by the muse or whatever as far as that experience goes to even think about turning it into a song. It was that homeless man walking by, or that dwelling deficient man. We can come up with all kinds of ways to say it. It was him walking by that triggered the memory, really. And then he kind of set the pace, the moving through the country, gonna eat a lot. He wasn't singing it. He was just saying it over and over.
Had the 1990 incident not have happened,
right?
Would you, when this happened with this man, do you think the song still would have come to fruition?
Oh, if the memory of the drugs and the peaches weren't there? No, I don't think so. I don't think so because it was a really vivid experience. I mean, I took LSD maybe like 5 times and all of them had different characteristics that were really memorable and useful. And I'm totally done taking psychedelics now because my doors of perception are open. So I don't need to open them further. If I do that, I'll just put them through the wall and then I'll have to repair the wall.
Okay.
So yeah, every trip had a memory, you know, had a very vivid experience and that was that one's. So without that, I don't think so. I think I would have just written it off as the ramblings of a challenged individual.
All right. Well, looking back on my notes here, Chris, it says Peaches was the third single, whether or not it's here nor there, from the band's self-titled debut album that eventually went triple platinum. Peaches was released on February 27th, 1996, track number 6 on the record. And of course, it was produced by Conrad Uno, who was the founder of Pop Llama Records, worked with a ton of other bands, Mudhoney, friends of ours, the Ergs, he's worked with them. Peaches, the song, peaked at number 29 on the Hot 100 and number 8 on the Billboard Modern Rock chart, which, again, for a song like this, it's incredible, which makes me then say, okay, it was the 90s. There was some wacky stuff getting on the radio then.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there was a real kind of inclusive, freeform, you know, subculture bubbling to the surface of pop culture vibe going on, you know, like, the predominant sound in Seattle, of course, being heavy guitars and weird time signatures and histrionic vocals and kind of macho, grungy kind of thing. That breaking out and being a nationwide flavor was super revolutionary. And I think everybody's radars were just on and available for new, for novel. We played a ton of shows in our early days because we wanted to run the experiment. Like if we just, you know, we're nobody, but if we book, you know, 3 shows a week, can we build something? And the soil was so fertile because everybody wanted to see the next big thing. You know, like there was this hunger for like, okay, grunge has arced, kind of, you know, Kurt Cobain's passing sort of put a downslope on the arc of that style, I guess, you know, at least as far as what you know, as far as buzz goes and all that kind of stuff, I mean, I'm sure people continue to love that kind of music, and I loved it. So it was just like everybody's radars were hot and on and open and being like, what's next? What's next? What's next? So that helped a lot. As far as like something as weird as the song Peaches goes, people were just feeling generous with their patience and available to be shown something new.
Well, and a lot of times when you say something had its 15 minutes of fame, that's like a derogatory term. But, you know, this song is still out there. I still hear it, you know, malls and stores. And
yeah.
Now with TikTok reels and stuff, it's showing up in different things like that. But, you know, just speaking about that time period, 96, 97, I remember not being able to go anywhere. Someone was humming that.
Yeah.
Millions of Peaches. They were singing it. It was just woven into, I don't know, Americana culture at that point.
Yeah, totally. I always think about that guy who wandered by the bus stop. Like, has he heard it?
I guess he hasn't come after you for any lyrical credit.
I guess not. I have no idea who he is, of course. If he's out there, you know, call me at 555-555-5555. That's one too many fives. Yeah, so, yeah, it was everywhere. There's a nice memory I have or an experience I had recently, not back in the 90s, but it was an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Larry David is working on a show called Young Larry, and he goes to see this actor performing in a band who wants the part. And so he's checking out this band, and he's checking out this actor and getting to see if it's a match or whatever. And the song that this actor is playing on stage is Peaches, but he's doing this incredibly industrial, jagged, weird, terrible version of Peaches. And then the scene cuts to backstage. It's Larry and this young actor, and they're talking, and Larry says, "Let me ask you something. What would possess you to sing such an idiotic song?"
Did you write that Peaches song?
No, technically I didn't write the Peaches song. No.
Okay. What would prompt a person to sing such an idiotic song?
Because the way it's aged 20 years later, don't you see how relevant it is now?
No, I don't.
Okay. See, I can take the honesty.
Yeah, you could take it.
I can take criticism.
Of course. You know? Yeah. You know?
What great
able
artist
to.
Couldn't?
Name one who could.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
You're looking at him.
You want the straight dope?
Give it to me. I promise you I can take it. I'm ready to grow.
In two words,
yeah.
It stunk.
Go fuck yourself.
I said you could take it.
I'm at home alone watching Curb Your Enthusiasm on my laptop, and I'm just like, it's me, that's me, that question. You know, like, he's upset about me and my song. That's so great.
That I'm just sitting here tripping out because I'm using the word tripping out again. I think yeah. I'm feeling some of your vibes here from 1990. I'm thinking back to Lump when all of a sudden you're looking across some Weird Al Yankovic on your bus going, how did this happen to me?
Yeah.
You know, now here you're sitting alone, and I've had it happen before where one of my songs will come on in a movie or something from my band, and it'll just be me at 2 a.m. and or a reference. Somebody
yeah.
One time we were an answer on Jeopardy or something, and someone will send it to me, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, it was something like this genre is called ska punk. They're from Florida or something. It was Less Than Jake. And it just, those kinds of things make me laugh so hard. Because again, you're right. You have the feeling like you want to tell somebody, but you're sitting in your apartment on your laptop and there's Larry David talking about you.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. I mean, it's a real feather in the cap to be like the focus of Larry David's anger.
Yeah. That is so awesome. Well, Chris, I want to dive into this thing. It's 2 minutes and 51 seconds. The intro, the first four bars, it's a lone guitar panned off left, followed by 8 bars of the bass guitar. Very warbly, odd sound on that bass. I'm also hearing a signal note, like a droney thing happening, panned off to the right. And I'm not sure, Chris, if that's an overtone of the bass guitar or maybe one of the pedals it's going through.
Well, what's going on there is a few things. Number one, when I wrote the riff that became the main riff, the da 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 da, it was kind of following what that guy was, the rhythm that the guy was doing. But melodically, I was sort of doing a halftime She Sells Sanctuary by The Cult. You know
what?
That? Yeah. The da 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 da.
We'll be right back.
I love that song, and it was kind of It was like a sort of slowed down, groovified. In my mind, this is a case where, of course, you know, this is the beautiful thing about a two-string and a three-string guitar. You can take your influences, wear them on your sleeve, and nobody knows that you're doing it because it's being filtered through this limitation of a couple of strings.
Right.
So to me, that's always been my like halftime cult riff.
I never would have picked that out. Yeah. She Sells Sanctuary is one of my top 25 songs ever. It's amazing. I never would have picked that out. Also, as we comb through the song, Chris, admittedly, I'm probably going to ask you, like, is this a guitar or a bass? It's very difficult to tell sometimes, especially when you start strumming stuff on the bass. Some of that stuff that happens is really cool.
Yeah. And that weird warbly sound is because I was playing a Kawai Japanese guitar, really cheap, with two strings. And then I was playing it through a accordion amp, which I guess foreshadows my relationship with Weird Al.
An accordion amp. What would possess you to do that?
Well, I went one time to see this. I was always after a really full low-end bass sound, and I was playing this two-string, so I was kind of, you know, limiting myself just because it was a guitar with two strings on it, but I was trying to get a nice fat tone. And I saw this jazz band somewhere, and the upright bass player was playing through a polytone amp, and I made a note of it, like, okay, this sounds really good. So I figured out that there was an accordion music, like an accordion centric music store in Seattle called Potosa Music. And I went there and they had this nice, juicy 115, you know, speaker accordion amp, which felt like a beautiful, buttery sound when I plugged my guitar into it. So I bought it and it had built in effects and it had this vibrato effect. And I had a foot pedal so I could turn it on and off. So it kind of like, I think, Body has it. So I scattered it around on the record a few places, and that was one of them.
That is awesome. Well, I mean, there's a couple guys that were doing. I remember the guitar player from Local H. He was running some pretty cool stuff, and we played with those guys. He had like a whole bass rig. He was doing like a split signal thing, and then there was a band from England years ago had two bass players called Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
But oh yeah,
where you took the instruments, it was just like the whole accordion thing is just absolutely amazing. Right out of the intro, it's the same chord progression. We get into what is, you know, and I wouldn't have necessarily thought of this as the chorus. I would think of this as kind of like a verse, but then what's the verse? So this has to be the chorus.
Yeah, we were taking first of all, before we go on, that little weird tone in the background, that the two time.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave played on the basic track. We played live drums. Two string and three string were live. Then we were going to do an overdub. And I think we just put Dave on the whole track. So he's getting ready to be the distorted guitar in the loud part, but he's just kind of playing, like hitting a note and then turning up the volume to kind of add a little harmonic in there. So that's what that is.
That's awesome.
Moving to the country. I'm going to eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches.
Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat me a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. And, you know, on that line, gonna eat me a lot of peaches. That's kind of, you know, backwoods. Was that the intention?
Gonna eat me a lot of peaches. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's a, like you'll notice elsewhere on the record, you know, like Back Porch, and then in subsequent records, there's definitely a piece of our pie chart of influences that's, you know, country music from my dad and his family. So yeah, I guess that was me just adding a little like bouncy country moment to it or something. I don't know. I'm trying to mix it up too, so I didn't just say the same thing four times, you know?
I found myself sitting here and I never evoked laughter, this song, to me till I was breaking it down. I'm hearing your accent. I'm sitting here laughing to myself. I'm like, there's parts of this that are really funny if you just take it for face value, you know? I'm trying to get to the deep meaning of the song here, but just face value, it's hilarious.
Part of that is we're singing these silly lyrics, but we're not doing it in a wacky voice or something, you know, or we're not trying to be wacky. We're just trying to be, I like the way we kind of took surreal nonsense imagery and then put it up against an actually good song that we were, you know, we weren't just trying to be like cartoonish all the time. But, you know, that whole loud, quiet thing, you know, it was a conscious decision to do what Nirvana was kind of doing, which is like quiet verse, loud chorus, like extreme loud, quiet. But we reversed it. So the chorus is the quiet.
Yeah.
The verse is the loud part.
Well, and that's why it kind of seems backwards. And to the listener, for me, I was like, wait a second, this is the chorus. That's crazy. The first four lines, it's a single dry vocal over those intro chords that we hear. On the back half, another bass guitar off to the right, I think it's another one, comes in playing a moving chord riff. There's also another unison vocal. It's not super tight or lined up, that comes in and branches off into a harmony for the last two lines. You kind to get like a unison harmony thing kind of going back and forth there. How conscious were you of that? Was like this has to be loose, because it feels like a jam. But again, something like this, you know, I guess in the 90s it worked, but it almost shouldn't get on the radio. It's very loose.
Yeah, it was loose because we recognized that was our strength, kind of like, you know. Where that's just that was maybe the limitations of our patience with, you know, being kind of militant about arrangements and harmonies and stuff like that. Also, we had a real kind of, we wanted a live vibe. You know, we were sort of trying to capture what we did live, but then also overdub onto it. So we were kind of trying to occupy both spaces where it's loose, but it's also we're expanding and adding guitars and adding harmonies. So typically, I think when Dave did his overdub, that was kind of destined for the loud parts, we also had a hot mic on for me doing vocals. So we try to do things at the same time. And then when we did background vocals, we would do them together around a mic. So we'd have this like fun party time. Later on subsequent albums, we got sort of brainwashed into thinking, well, the background vocals have to be isolated and, you know, we have to be able to control everything later. And that sort of, you know, happy accident randomness got choked off. And I think, to our detriment, it got choked off. So
I can't imagine taking these tracks and running them through Pro Tools, lining everything up, tuning all the vocals, it wouldn't be the same thing. And I always wonder, if you were to have done something like that to a song like this, would it have still been a hit?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, I think sonically this record is so weird that, you know, Dave and Jason and I all sometimes, you know, we'll just start talking about how bizarre it is that this weird sounding record with this like almost like a heavy metal kick drum and these weird, instruments that when you hit them too hard, they go bang, you know,
nothing
like
sounds like this. Nothing, yeah, right. At the time, the only thing that I could say is there's a little bit of a Weezer vibe in the verses, you know, but that's just because of, you know, it's drop D flat or whatever. And it's just kind of, you know, what was happening at the time. But everything else is just like, what is this?
Peaches come from a can. They were put there by a man. If I had my little way, I'd eat peaches every day. Sun soaking bulges in the shade.
Peaches come from a can. They were put there by a man in a factory downtown. If I had my little way, I'd eat peaches every day. Sun soaking bulges in the shade.
Yeah. All of that is the Mary Lou LSD moment. Because again, her house was in this otherwise very like kind of gray kind of, you know, machine shop world. So that was the factory, the, you know, put there by a man in a factory downtown was kind of like my memory of the neighborhood. And, you know, just the desire, if I had my way, I'd do this, I'd eat peaches every day. I just want to like live in this like decadent drug filled haze. If I had my way, I would do that, but I don't.
Her name was Mary Lou?
Yeah, Mary Lou Lord.
Did she ever know it was about her? Did she privy to it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't think I have talked to her. I don't think I've talked to her since that record came out. We may have corresponded over social media a little bit. I'm not sure, but anyway, I've kind of lost track of Mary Lou. One other weird coincidence, weird connection with Mary Lou is she dated Kurt Cobain for a hot minute and had pictures of him all over her refrigerator. So that was another bizarre connection.
Yeah. And would the peach be a kind of a metaphor for her?
Oh, sure. I mean, it was like a, you know, a peach is a peach. I mean, you look at it a certain way and, you know, if you're a certain kind
of... Gotcha.
You see what you see. Yeah, so squishing the peaches was like a sensory sexual experience. It was kind of like a stand-in for an orgasm or something. You know, it was a stand-in for having sex, basically.
I'm going to be calling every nursery in town looking for a peach tree, Chris, in my backyard.
Doesn't hurt to have one around for those lean times.
Chorus one, we get this drum fill kind of out of nowhere that brings us into verse one. This part is driving so hard. Are the stereo guitars, I'm hearing them left and right. Is that a guitar left and a bass off to the right, or is there a guitar off to the right too?
Ooh, that's a good question. I haven't listened to it in such a long time. I would imagine that, I think our idea at that time was to be more like John Spencer Blues Explosion, the way they treated drums and guitars. In our minds, we were a little more drums to guitars. And I had a Rat distortion pedal. And I think they were, Conrad was taking a direct signal from my little weird two string and the amp. So I think what happened is at that point, Dave kicked in with an overdubbed. So his clean guitar is panned to one side and my bass is panned to another. And then when it kicks in, there's an added electric on Dave's side that's Big Muff kind of sound.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and I kick in the distortion on my side. And then I think the direct signal from my bass might be in the middle.
Peaches. Peaches come from a can. They were put there by a man.
So it's kind of like a smorgasbord of different stuff going on.
It's definitely some distinct sounds that are panned left and right for this, what I'm calling the stereo image. But I also have to, is this a wood block I'm hearing sporadically here in verse one?
Yeah. Well, here was the idea. When Dave and I started playing together in the version that ended up becoming the President's, we had no drummer. And the idea was we don't need a drummer. We don't want a drummer. Drummers take up all this space with all this noise and stuff. And the hi-hat's the loudest thing, and it's the smallest piece of gear. What's up with that? So Jason saw us playing with and without. We had a friend sitting in on drums here and there, and we play without a drummer. So one of the things we loved about Jason was his willingness to get rid of all of his cymbals except for a tiny splash. And we replaced it with a wood block and a cowbell on a tree, you know, like a little stand. And so he was hogtied, you know, like, because he was used to playing a full kit Love Battery, just like,
right.
And he did such a great job. Like, he listened to the lyrics and he listened to sort of the energetic flow of the song, and he wasn't about imposing a sort of, you know, binary zeros and ones kind of stability to the track as much as like kind of flowing with us. So anyway, I think that little riff and all that little stuff on the cowbells and stuff is just him. Part of it is him trying to find his feet with this weird new drum kit. You know, he's just having fun finding his way, I think, a little bit.
I love the fact that you neutered your drummer, okay?
Yeah.
You completely said, you don't get all your toys, pal, but he somehow made this part sound heavier than if I think he had a full kit.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds so driving and big, but there's not much going on.
I know. Part of it is I went in Boston in the early 90s. I went to see this band called Pianosaurus, and they played all toys that they bought at Toys R Us. So they would, you know, it's like a little Elmo guitar and a Sesame Street drum kit, but they were all mic'd and so well mic'd. And this is a big theater I saw them in. So well mic'd and through this big PA that it sounded heavy. Like, not,
yeah,
they distorted stuff and artificially made them heavy. It's just that they made that, those toys just like occupy all this space.
Corner, 'cause there ain't no road map for the highway. Love is a two-way street. Love is a two-way street now. Love is a two-way street.
And that really stuck in my mind as like a beautiful sort of way to play with heaviness and lightness and, you know, machismo versus like a more kind of, dorky approach. So, yeah, we were kind of riding the line between macho and dorky the whole time.
Foot and a wall to touch it. A kitty and a foot and a wall to touch it.
Hey, everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more of the 200th episode of Chris DeMakes a Podcast with Chris Ballou after a few words from our sponsors.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock. DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with the Spotify Canvas Generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/DeMakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/DeMakes.
And now, back to the show.
Verse one, we get harmonies on Peaches Come From a Can, and They Were Put There by Man, as well as on If I Had My Little Way and I'd Eat Peaches Every Day. On the lines that come after that, at the top of verse one and at the back end, it's just you alone. Then we move into chorus two. Much like chorus one, the guitar is pan left and the bass guitar is off to the right, along with some cool hi-hat rhythm stuff and a lone vocal for the first four lines here. But the band is playing with much more intensity than chorus one. It's just everything just seems a little louder here.
To the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches.
The lyrics are pretty much the same for the first half, except gonna eat a lot of peaches. We don't get the me on this line.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What's up there?
I don't know. And I've always, so the end of the second line in that chorus, the quiet second chorus, I go, gonna eat a lot of peaches. I kind of drop that note. Goes
yeah.
And in the video, I decided to really acknowledge it. So if you watch the video at the end of that line, I'm like, peaches. I kind of do this like, this facial, acknowledgement of my flubbed tone there.
I noticed that part when where it kind of drops off, and I can't explain what emotion it even evokes me. Again, it kind of makes me want to giggle a little bit. It's funny.
Yeah. In if we were making that record today, we would have fixed that. But we were, the previous recording experience we'd had before being with Conrad at Egg was working with Barrett Jones at the Laundry Room, and it was like a 12 hours for $350 deal. You could do whatever you want in the Laundry Room studio and we made an entire album in 12. Actually, we did it in 13 hours. We pushed it a little bit, but so we were used to just like slash and go with recording. So I think that kind of spilled over when it came time to that was like we considered it like a demo tape, but making the Pop Llama album was more like making an album. But we still had that sort of rough and ready, like, well, it is what it is,
That's the beauty of it, and the beauty of your band was lost on me back in the 90s. I wasn't there. I told you this last time, what I've went back and listened to these records, I'm like, wow, these guys were on their own trip. They were on their own own vision. I absolutely love it. On the back half of chorus two, another unison vocal joins along with the drums, which are now in, along with that bass guitar panned right. It gets really playful on this back half. And on the last three lines, gonna eat a lot of peaches, moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Those harmonies, again, are mixed in with your unison vocals. They're loose. They're kind of weaving in and out, but they're awesome.
Yeah, and that's a function of how we did background vocals. Just like I said, like around a mic, kind of jostling each other, having fun, and just playing with the song. And nothing was set in stone at that point because we hadn't performed that song that many times. So it was all kind of, yeah, loose and exploratory. And that it's a beautiful thing to capture, that like when a song is still flowering and not really fully fruited yet, it's a really cool... It's cool that we were able to capture that that vibe.
No, and have you ever thought now, you know, 25, 30 years later, how do you go back? How do you go back to that default setting of, yeah, I'm just this 23-year-old kid and that, it's good enough. We're not going to line these vocals up and tune them, you know, because I know now that it's hard for me to digress like that. It's hard for me to go back and think that way because I've learned so much, and sometimes learning isn't the greatest thing.
Yeah. It really depends on your intention, like as a songwriter. And you know, like precision has a place and sloppiness has a place. They're like colors in the paint box, right? You know, you've got your instruments, you've got your vocals, you've got the BPMs, you've got what key it's in. And then you've also got how tight or loose things are. And for me, it's just like a toggle switch that I, you know, play with. Lately, of course, with solo stuff I'm making now, I'm really into sort of crafting something that's got like each part has this balance and harmonic richness and stuff like that. So it's just, I don't feel like I've lost something. I've just kind of gained another, you know, tool in my toolbox. But yeah, it's wonderful that we had that opportunity to be that loose. I think some people never get that or don't give themselves the license to be sloppy, because out of that sloppiness can come really great stuff that either you leave sloppy or you tighten up. But it's definitely I listen to a lot of old demos and old fragments for ideas for this new solo stuff I'm doing, and I marvel at how loose and weird I was. Like, I allowed myself to be so screwed up. You know what really influenced me, you know, Lou Barlow, the bass player from Dinosaur Jr.?
Oh yeah.
So he had a band called Sebado, and before that had a thing called Centrado, which is cassettes that he made with a four-string ukulele, baritone uke. And that was really, that is really just like almost confessional, like sloppy, weird, you know, unique.
Something in your eyes I misunderstood. Something that was bad I took for. Down this dream on which I stood. Now you never will, and I always thought you would.
I actually just talked to him on the phone the other day, and we became fast friends, and we were reviewing that whole idea of like being, allowing yourself to be so weird and sloppy. So it is, I think it's important to allow yourself to do that as a songwriter, and then you have the decision to make now, is tightening it up appropriate? Is that going to get me to where I want to go, or do I leave it loose? But anyway, both are fine.
That's such a great explanation you gave. Thank you. I never really thought about it like that. I always thought for me, it was kind of black and white. Like I can't go back there. I can only do this. But the way that you described it, it's kind of like, no, this is all the tools in my box, my tackle box over here. It's just, you know, I choose when to use them. That's a great way to look at it.
And choose when to release them. I mean, like, if you don't think about when you're being sloppy, don't think about that this is going to see the light of day even. Just go. And then, yeah, then you have a choice. You have a fork in the road. Do I leave it sloppy? Do I tighten it? And then that's up to you.
Well, we got some great lyrics here in verse two. Same basic instrumentation as verse one, but the whole band, again, is singing and playing with more intensity than they were in verse one.
I took a little nap with a loose old twist. Squished a rotten peach in my fist. And dreamed about you, a woman. I broke my finger down inside. Make a little room for it to hide. Nature's candy in my hand, or can or pie.
Took a little nap where the roots all twist. Squished a rotten peach in my fist. And dreamed about you, woman. I poked my finger down inside. Make a little room for an ant to hide. Nature's candy in my hand, or can or pie. And the way you say pie there is just, it's this abrupt, like it was like a mistake. And then the song ends there and like this weird edit comes in. Yeah. Like what is happening there?
I know. Well, that was just a fun. Well, first of all, those lyrics, I love that verse.
Me too.
I think I had, if you look at the somewhere online or somewhere, there's the original handwritten lyrics. And I think that line, took a little nap where the roots all twist. It was like referred directly to having been on LSD. It was like took a little drugs, or I can't remember what it was, but Dave Dieterer said, we got to like, you know, poeticize that line. We got to put the metaphor back in there a little bit because it's a little too like, we do drugs.
Yeah. You're like, we're not ween, but we're close.
Yeah. Oh my God. I wanted to be ween. Bad. I mean, that's another influence. I mean, the pod was like in my blood.
Oh, come on.
Pod and yeah, ween and Centrado, man. If anybody wants to understand where the presidents were coming from, those are the albums.
Very cool.
Anyway, yeah, so that was really a nice moment where I was kind of pushed to find a more poetic way to kind of write that line. So took a little nap where the roots all twist, squished a rotten peach in my fist. I mean, that's just like what I was doing. There were, because the ones that were on the ground were rotten. The ones from the tree were like all sexy and beautiful. But the rotten ones, and then pushed my finger down inside, made a little room for an ant to hide. So I'd make like a little cave in the rotten peach. And then one time an ant crawled in there and was crawling around. So really, again, just exactly what I saw. And then what's the last line?
Nature's candy.
Yeah. Nature's candy. I'm a hand or a can or pie. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Or pie. Like, it's still like, I sat there and rewound that part in particular, like five times. And every time I'm just like, I still don't get it, but I love it.
Well, I was just imagining like all the ways peaches could be enjoyed, I guess, you know.
Okay.
Pie, you know, whatever your choice is, you know.
Well, I got to tell you, Chris, the song is only at 1:36 at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. You still got another minute and a half of the song. And then I start analyzing the parts on what I'm calling the outro hook. And it's just, it's incredible how many times you kept this going, but it never loses intensity.
Right.
And I absolutely love this part. Was this recorded to tape? I can't remember when we talked about Lump, or was this on ADAT?
Yeah, it was tape. It was definitely tape. It was, if I remember, it was half inch, 16 track.
Okay. And now, was this back section we're about to talk about, was this recorded separate from the rest of the track? Because it sounds like it's not.
No, it's just exactly, the whole basic track is exactly as performed by us live in the studio, and then we added stuff. But yeah, the backbone of the track is a live take.
Well, pardon me on my first note here. It sounds like this section was crudely edited together with the last section.
No, the crudeness was all live.
But that's beautiful. That is so cool, because you know what? The reason I thought it was spliced, it not only does it not sound natural, I'm amazed that you guys could have played it that way.
I know. It's funny. I mean, we really did, like I said before, it was all I had was verse, chorus. And then I played that for them in the rehearsal space, and we're just like, well, what do we do now? We don't want to do another chorus. And Dave came up with that part. I don't remember exactly how he played it. I think it must have been in the rehearsal space. I don't know if he came up with it outside and brought it in. I don't really remember, but it was just a welcome breath of fresh air. And I don't, you know, we don't have any other songs that do that kind of gear shift, I don't think, in
Not that I can definitely not like this.
I'm trying to think too of like in pop music or in even rock and roll, is there another example of a song that stops and then goes a different direction? I'm not sure. There probably is. But
well, and also another no-no at radio back in the 70s, 80s, and probably even into the 90s was you never stop a hit single. radio programmers didn't like that, you know, and you're breaking almost every rule here.
I know. And not only is the song really weird, but here's some dead air.
Yeah. Here's something else that's going to be strange with it. Well, the first four bars are just guitar panned off to the left. On bar four, there's a falsetto yeah vocal that comes in. Then the drums and the bass guitar panned off to the right join in. And we get another yeah right around bar eight. The band continues on for another eight bars before the vocals kick in. A third yeah happens right before the 12th bar. Millions of peaches, peaches for me. Millions of peaches, peaches for free. Millions of peaches, peaches for me. Millions of peaches, peaches for free. Look out. There's harmonies on each one of those lines there. Again, they're kind of loose. There's some unison words, but it's mostly harmonized. I'm assuming these are your lyrics. These weren't the man in Seattle, right? This is you saying this.
Yeah, that's Dave Dieterer wrote those lines. Yeah. And that's okay. Jason Finn is doing the high harmony, actually. He had this great, gravelly high, like, millions of peaches kind of thing.
And then after you got the lookout, nothing really changes except the intensity of the band. We get a 24-bar instrumental. The hi-hat opens up. The guitars go to these big open strumming patterns. On bar 16, there's a super buried yeah in there. Almost sounds like maybe a drum mic picked it up or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because from the live take. Yeah.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like it's way, way buried. And another single note guitar part or an overtone comes in. I'm hearing like these... Something else come in there on the back half of that instrumental. Do you recall?
I don't think so. I think that's just our different parts. Cause what was happening is Dave's going da 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 da. And I'm going da 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 da. So we're doing this like crossing harmonic.
That's awesome.
And it always bugged me. I didn't feel like my line was loud enough to lock those two lines in to feel like one thing. I was like, oh, I wish we'd pushed my line up just a little bit because Dave's guitar was more articulate than my bass. Anyway,
interesting.
It was always it's always like a. And then when we did it live, we kind of did mesh those two lines a little better. But that always to me was kind of like our AC/DC moment. And in fact, when we played it live, a lot of times I would start doing the Angus Young rooster step and just totally lean into that. Look out!
I always thought as a young kid that heavy, well, my first definition of it was it had to be faster than Metallica or Slayer. Okay, that's heavy. Right. And then it's got to be big guitars. It's got to be... My whole definition of heavy could come in all kinds of forms. For instance, you know, when you saw them on the Sesame Street instruments, you know, you said that it sounded big. It took up a lot of space, you know? And this part, this instrumental part that you guys are doing here is so heavy. It reminds me almost like of some of the slower Fugazi. It's got like this hardcore almost. Mm-hmm. It's got almost this hardcore element to it. It's like, totally. I never heard that back in the 90s. And analyzing it now, I'm like, gosh, there's so much more here under the hood than you think.
Wow, that's a great reference. I mean, I was also a huge Fugazi fan. I loved Fugazi. Would walk around.
Yeah.
Let's see, with it on my headphones, just digging it.
Yeah, it's something like Waiting Room or something. You know, it's just kind of, you know, makes you. No one can see me, but I'm actually kind of grooving and dancing, which I don't do much, Chris. I got two left feet, but
and you know, we were using the same pedals that Mudhoney was using, so there's sonically there's a reference point too. I mean, the Big Muff was a huge cornerstone part of our sound back then. Our idea with the Big Muff and distortion in general was, let's save it. In fact, I think we only used the Big Muff like three times in our set, or maybe twice. So we would save it as this like secret weapon to just go like, you know, like make everything explode.
Yeah.
It was great.
Oh, that's awesome. And then out of this 24 bars, that's a big piece of music. Again, this whole back section is half of the song, which is amazing. We get the same lyrics again. Millions of peaches, peaches for me, millions of peaches, peaches for free, repeated. And we get another lookout. And then the band stops abruptly. The bass guitar panned off right kind of slides off at the last minute. It's the last that you hear. Yeah. Again, right to the very end of this song, there's this playfulness and this looseness.
This looseness.
Looselessness. Is that a word?
Looseness, please. Yeah. Yeah, that was fun. I don't know what possessed us to make such a long sort of lyricless oasis, like desert in there. But I think part of it was, I also, another band that just blew me away and was an influence is Spaceman 3. The fearless use of 1-4-5 and the repetition, and just like even like, you know, songs like Naked and Famous on our album and and Stranger and stuff, they're directly for me like Spaceman 3 love letters. So I think that was part of it. It's just like, you know, let's give the music a second to just, let's give ourselves a second to just enjoy playing this monster riff. And, we were just having too much fun to make it stop.
Well, I had too much fun breaking it down. And I got to tell you, it was fantastic having you here a couple of years ago to break down Lump. And thank you for coming back, Chris. You're one of the, I'm not just saying this, you're our 200th episode. You are our 100th episode. Now you're the 200th. You're one of my favorite songwriters. You're very fascinating, your approach. A lot of the things you said today were really cool. I'm gonna put them in my toolbox, my friend.
Cool.
Before we break, a couple months ago, you had a brand new solo album called Power Trip come out. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's I'm making this new music that's sort of fuzzy, psychedelic. I rediscovered, after 12 years of making music for little kids, I rediscovered my distortion pedal collection. And I'm like, yeah. So, and that morphed into rediscovering my synthesizer obsession that I had back in the 80s when I used to collect monophonic synthesizers. So I'm kind of mixing acoustic guitars and synthesizers and fuzz pedals and loops and stuff, and making this music that lyrically is about sort of what it's like to be in a conscious human being and all the fear and sort of self-doubt and self-awareness. And that's like the subject matter is way more expansive than it was with the Presidents, and really fun stuff to play with. I'm really into like Alan Watts and Ram Dass and philosophy. And so I'm mixing all these ideas and poetry with fuzzies and loopies. And I know this is not the greatest elevator pitch, and the elevator's already gone through the ceiling of the building, but I'm, I need to get it down to like, you know, two sentences, but, anyway, so it's really fun. And the volcano, whenever I find a purpose and a palette that really feel right, the floodgates open. And this is no exception. Like with the Presidents, it happened. With Casper Baby Pants, it happened. With my kids' music and with this. So anyway, I'm putting out two records a year in July and January for the foreseeable future. This is album number 6, Power Trip. And I feel like it's my best yet, but that's how everybody feels about their latest album. And it's super fun. I'm alone in a studio, which I have learned is my natural habitat. Being in a band was challenging in a lot of great ways, but also I think it was, I've come to terms with the fact that I'm not a great collaborator, really. I really love hours and hours at home, like a mad scientist pushing and pulling and experimenting. And I love deleting the guitar if it doesn't need guitar, or deleting the drums and not hurting anybody's feelings. So I'm like, really?
Except maybe your own.
Yeah. Like, You know, I'm really enjoying being ruthless toward my vision and only hurting myself.
I love it. I love it. Well, so refreshing to hear. I love how prolific you are later in your career. It's inspiring. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Just everybody who's a songwriter out there, just keep playing and let yourself be sloppy and loose. You'll never know. I think the answer might be lying underneath the shit.
I was the thief in the family, addicted to the video game. I got low so I could get high. I went blind so I could grow eyes. I got tight so I could unwind. I unplugged so life would be bright.
I'm losing my power trip. I'm losing my power trip. I'm losing my power trip.
Hey everybody, that song you were just hearing is the title track from Chris Ballew's new album Power Trip. So make sure you go check that out. And don't go anywhere, we got lots more Chris Makes a Podcast coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget, and we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one-hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, email your best song and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is The Brake Plans, a modern-day 80s-influenced pop rock band from Freehold, New Jersey. You can check them out online, and you can find their music on all the streaming sites. Here's a snippet of their song, Fashionably Late.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Chris, could we have asked for a better 200th episode?
Oh, man. He's the perfect guest. He loves talking about his songs to the point of, I mean, the guy went and bought an amp for an accordion to run his bass through. I mean, he's the ultimate musical nerd. I've met my match. I love Chris.
He is the ultimate amalgamation of awesome storyteller and just innovative songwriter. You can't ask for a better guest for what we do on this podcast. I already booked him for episode 300. So in 2 years, 2 years from now, we got to get him back on. He already agreed. So we know that that's going to be a good episode.
I mean, he takes acid, LSD in 1990, and then like 4 years later, he sees some guy mumbling to himself in Seattle, halfway across the country. He connects the dots and decides to write a song called Peaches. Who does that?
I would say only, and I don't use this word lightly, I don't like to throw this word around, but geniuses? Would you say?
I guess. Yeah. A genius or a crazy person, and that straddles a fine line. But just so much going on in this song. He's sitting under the peach tree of a woman that used to date Kurt Cobain. Yeah. The accordion amp, just the guy is just, and the song. Like, I can't believe, Chris, that this wasn't edited together. It sounds like two different performances, and the fact that they, as a band, created this live off the floor, and that's what you hear, it's incredible.
Well, the thing that I think about with this song, and I loved how he put it, he said he loves surreal nonsense imagery put up against an actually good song. Like, you could make a funny song and have it be silly and stupid. This is a funny song that is in no way stupid. Maybe Larry David thinks so. But other than that, it's an awesome song. I remember the first time I heard this and just like my mind being blown. I was a teenager and heard this song. I'm like, oh my God, just talking to all my friends about it. Did you hear this song about the peaches, about eating peaches? Have you heard this? And it grabs your attention and keeps it. It's so fun. It's so exciting. It's unforgettable too. Never has there been another song like this.
No, and in fact, the only thing I could, even if someone were to say, well, what does this band sound like? Just the verses in this song. I'm like, I even said it to Chris. It has kind of like that 90s Weezer kind of vibe. The guitars are down-tuned. But other than that, I mean, nothing sounds like this. He's talking about, you know, his love for Ween, which I can hear. His love for Fugazi. And then some of the more obscure bands he was mentioning. John Spencer Blues Explosion and different things. It's just cool. You know, I don't think he was trying to be innovative in any way. I think he was just some wacky kid in the bedroom with just like to collect gear. He mentioned he likes to, you know, collect 80s synthesizers and different things and hook them up weird. And he was just like a mad scientist.
I thank goodness all the time that the mid-90s happened, when there was this boom of wild and eccentric music, that a song like this could become a hit. That's like one of the only times I can think of where a song like this, I mean, a song like this could become like popular at any time, I guess, but a hit, it had to be at that time. The timing was just right. And I freaking love it. Yeah, it was the era where Ween could become popular and be on a major label and stuff. It was the perfect time for it. It's such a memorable time. This song is just,
and remember, this was before social media and the TikTok generation. I mean, yeah, any weird song could get popular right now, a snippet for 30 seconds or something. But this was a full song at commercial radio in the mid-90s, and absolutely love it. There's a lot going on here, you know, on the surface. And I mentioned to Chris, as I did last time with Lump, this band just was not on my radar in the 90s. I remember Roger talking about them, oh, presidents. And I just kind of, you know, if it was on the radio, I didn't really want to hear it. You know, maybe Green Day got a pass. But with a straight face, one of my favorite bands now, going back and discovering their catalog has been awesome.
Chris, did you know that I never had a peach? I never ate an actual peach until like 2019. And then we were on tour and we were driving through Georgia and there was a roadside stand. I mean, I had peach flavored things, but I never had an actual peach, bit into a peach. And I had my first peach at a roadside stand and we filmed it. And we put it in our Punchline Music special. And it was the perfect first peach to ever have, because it was at a Georgia roadside stand. It wasn't something sitting in some grocery store or something.
Georgia's the peach state. I do remember you telling that story. I'm glad, because you can get a bitter peach. You can get a hard peach. There's a fine line between the rotten ones that Chris's was squeezing and the one that sounded like you got down in Georgia, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a nice peach. And speaking of nice peaches, Chris, our listeners are some of the sweetest peaches out there.
They certainly are.
If you're listening to this right now, we really appreciate you and we really do think you're a peach. And hey, We have an Instagram account for the Krista Makes a Podcast now. The Krista Makes a Podcast, as I like to call it. Go check it out, because we know this is an audio-only podcast, but I've been putting clips up there for you to check out. I'll take out like a minute or a minute and a half and put it out there because, I don't know, people like to see your face, Chris. I think they want to see you.
Absolutely, yeah. Go give us a follow over there, and give Chris Fafalius a follow on Instagram, too. He loves a good follow, as do I. I'm at Less Than Chris D over on Instagram. And I want to thank this week's guest, our 200th episode, Mr. Chris Ballew, from the Presidents of the United States of America. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, Chris Makes a Podcast producer, Chris Fafalius here. You may have heard me talk about my band Punchline before. Maybe you already know us, or maybe you're hearing about us for the first time right now. It doesn't matter. No matter what your relationship with Punchline is, I will absolutely guarantee that you'll love our new podcast, A Band Called Punchline. Starting with our humble beginnings in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania in 1997, we're telling the hilarious, strange, and hopefully inspiring story of the 25 plus years of our band in the most honest way possible, podcast style. A Band Called Punchline is an audio documentary available now wherever you get your pods. So subscribe and let me and my friends share a wild, entertaining, unique, and wonderful tale of music and perseverance unlike any other that's still being written today.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street Podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.